Chapter 21. Chang stopped walking, like a reflex, and Reacher stopped alongside her. He said, "No room at the inn." She said, "Their next move." They walked on, getting closer, changing the geometry, seeing deeper inside the horseshoe, seeing groups of men just standing around and waiting, filling the empty parking slots, kicking the curbs, standing in the traffic lanes. Maybe 30 guys in total, including whichever Moynihan it was who had gotten kicked in the nuts. He looked a little pale, but no smaller than before. His hapless relative wasn't there, probably still in bed, dosed up on painkillers. Reacher said, "We'll go straight to my room." Chang said,
"Are you nuts? We'll be lucky to get as far as the car."
"I bought new clothes. I need to change."
"Bring them with you. You can change later."
It was already a concession not to change in the store. I don't like carrying stuff around.
"We can't fight 30 people.
They moved on and stopped 20 feet from the staircase they needed. There were three guys near it. All of them were looking toward the office, where the one-eyed guy was coming out and hustling across, waving and gesturing. When he arrived, he said, "Mr. Keever's booking has come to an end, as has his associates, therefore, and I'm afraid they can't be renewed. At this time of year, I take empty rooms out of circulation for a day or two, for necessary maintenance, ready for the harvest." Reacher said nothing. "We can't fight 30 people." To which Reacher's natural response was, "Why the hell not?" It was in his DNA, like breathing. He was an instinctive brawler, his greatest strength and his greatest weakness. He was well aware of that, even as he ran through the mechanics of the problem in his mind, one against 30. The first 12 were easy. He had 15 rounds in the Smith, and wouldn't miss with more than 3. And assuming Chang took the hint, she could add another 6, or thereabouts. She was white-collar, but on the other hand, the range was short and the targets were numerous, which would leave maybe 12 remaining after the guns jammed empty, which was more than he could remember taking on before all at once, but which had to be feasible. A lot would depend on shock, he supposed, which would be considerable, presumably. The noise, the muzzle flashes, the shell cases arcing through the bright morning sunlight, the guys going down. It had to be feasible. But it wasn't. He couldn't fight 30 people, not at that point. Not without better information. He had no probable cause. He said, "When is checkout time?" The one-eyed guy said,
11 o'clock.
And then he clammed up, visibly like he wished he had never spoken. Reacher said,
"And what time is it now?"
The one-eyed guy didn't answer. "It's 9:03, Reacher said. "We'll be gone well before 11 o'clock. That's a promise. So everyone can relax now. There's nothing to see here." The one-eyed guy stood still, deciding. Eventually he nodded. The three men near the stairs stood back, just half a pace, but their intention was clear. They weren't going anywhere, but they weren't going to do anything either. Not yet. Reacher went up the stairs behind Chang and unlocked his door and stepped inside his room. Chang said,
"Are we really leaving at 11 o'clock?
"Before 11, Reacher said. "In 10 minutes, probably. There's no point in staying here. We don't know enough."
"We can't just abandon Keever."
"We need to go somewhere we can at least use a phone." He dumped his new clothes on the bed and opened the plastic packets and pulled off the tags. He said, "Maybe I should take a shower."
"You took a shower 2 hours ago. I heard you through the wall."
"Did you?"
"You're fine. Just get dressed."
"You sure?" She nodded and locked the door from the inside and put the chain across. He carried his stuff to the bathroom and took off the old and put on the new. He put the Smith in one pocket and his toothbrush in the other, and his cash and his ATM card and his passport. He rolled up the old stuff and jammed it in the trash receptacle. He glanced in the mirror. He smoothed his hair with his fingers. Good to go. Chang called through,
"Reacher, they're coming up the stairs."
He called back, "Who are?"
"About 10 guys, like a deputation."
He heard her step back. He heard pounding on the door, angry and impatient. He came out of the bathroom and heard the lock rattling and the chain jiggling. He saw figures outside the window on the walkway, oppressive guys, some of them looking in through the glass. Chang said,
"What are we going to do?"
"Same as we always were," he said. "We're going to hit the road." He walked to the door and slid the chain off. He put his hand on the handle. "Ready?" he said. Chang said,
"As I'll ever be."
He opened the door. There was a surge outside, and the nearest guy stumbled forward. Reacher put the flat of his hand on the guy's chest and shoved him back. "Not gently," he said. "What?" The guy got set on his feet again, and he said,
"Checkout time. Just moved up."
"To when?"
"Now."
Reacher hadn't seen the guy before. Big hands, broad shoulders, a seamed face, clothes all covered with dirt. Chosen in some way, presumably, to be the point man, to be the spokesperson, the pick of the local litter, no doubt, according to popular acclaim. Reacher said, "What's your name?" The guy didn't answer. Reacher said,
"It's a simple question."
No response.
"Is it Maloney?"
"No,"
the guy said, with something in his voice like it was a stupid question. Reacher said,
"Why is this place called Mother's Rest?"
"I don't know."
"Go wait downstairs. We'll leave when we're ready." The guy said,
"We're waiting here."
"Downstairs," Reacher said again.
"With two ways of getting there. The other is head first over the rail. Your choice. Either method works for me."
Below them, the one-eyed guy was staring upward. Their suitcases had been moved nearer their car. They were side by side on the blacktop next to the tailgate door. The guy with the big hands and the dirty clothes made a face, part shrug, part sneer, part nod, and he said,
"Okay. You got 5 more minutes."
10 more, Reacher said. "I think that's what we'll take. Okay with you? And don't come up the stairs again." The guy got a look in his eye like some kind of mute challenge. Reacher said,
"What do you do for a living?"
The guy said,
"Hog farmer."
"Always?"
"Man and boy."
"Same place?"
"Near enough."
"No military service?"
"No."
"I thought not," Reacher said. "You let us take the high ground," which was dumb, because 30 guys don't mean squat if they have to come up a staircase 2 by 2. "You know we're armed. We could pick you off like squirrels from inside a cinder block building, which you can't hurt unless you're packing grenade launchers, which I don't think you are. So don't come up the stairs again. Especially not in the lead." The guy said nothing in reply to that, and Reacher stepped back and closed the door on him. Chang said,
"If our aim is to get out of here alive, I don't think you should be antagonizing them."
"I don't agree," Reacher said, "because as soon as we're gone, they're going to be asking themselves a question. Are we coming back? It's going to be the subject of a big debate. If we'd gone all meek and mild, they'd have known we were faking. Better to let them believe their stonewalling worked."
"It did. Like you said, we don't know anything."
"We know something." "I said we don't know enough."
"What do we know?"
"We know the clerk just called in a situation report.
He told his boss we'd be gone by 11 o'clock, but that wasn't good enough for the guy. The compromise wasn't acceptable. He wanted us gone right now, hence the 10 guys with the new message, which was a message we didn't get last night. Last night, we were welcomed with open arms. So what changed?
Chang said,
"The woman in white."
Exactly. The same guy who wants us gone right now didn't want the boat rocked while she was on the premises. But now she's gone, so it's back to business as usual.
Who was she, and where did she go?
We don't know. We don't know about the man in the suit either, except they were important somehow, as in everyone had to be on best behavior when they were around. I saw the clerk tidying up before the car came for the man in the suit. He lined up all the chairs before the guy got a look at the place in daylight.
They weren't investors. Not the kind that actually go inspect an investment anyway. They didn't have the vibe. I spent a lot of time with investors.
So what were they?
I have no idea. Someone's important guests or someone's best customers or something. How are we supposed to know? Maybe they're fugitives from justice. Maybe this is an underground railroad, but a niche market, club class only. Peace and quiet and a good night's sleep guaranteed and all road transfers by Cadillac for white-collar criminals.
Would the woman dress up for that?
Probably not,
Reacher said. I agree, it has a railroad feel. They get off the train, they spend the night in the motel, they move on the next morning by car. It feels very transient. It feels kind of one way, too, like this is a stop on a longer journey.
From where to where?
Reacher didn't answer. Chang said,
So, what now?
We'll head west and figure that out when your phone starts working.
After 10 minutes exactly, they opened the door and stepped out to the walkway. The 30 guys were still there below them, still corralled together in small independent groups, twos and threes and fours, collectively surrounding the little green Ford in a rough and distant semicircle. The nearest was the hog farmer, about 10 feet from the car. Next to him was the queasy Moynihan. Both of them looked tense and impatient. Reacher put his hand in his pocket, his palm and three fingers lightly on the Smith, and he started down the stairs with Chang right behind him. They got to the bottom, and she blipped the remote, and the car unlocked with a ragged thump that sounded very loud in the silence. Reacher stepped around the hood and looked at the hog farmer and said, "We'll go. As soon as you put our bags in the trunk." The hog farmer said,
"Put them yourself."
Reacher leaned back against the Ford with his hands in his pockets and his ankles crossed. Just a guy, waiting. All the time in the world, he said.
Apparently you felt comfortable packing them up and hauling them here, so I'm guessing you don't have a constitutional objection to touching our stuff.
Or an allergy,
or any other kind of disqualifying impediment. So now's the time to finish the job.
Put them in the car,
and we'll get going. That's what you want, right?
The guy said nothing. Reacher waited. The silence got worse. He could hear wheat stirring in the wind 100 yards away. No one moved. Then a guy looked at the next guy, who looked back, and pretty soon everyone was looking at everyone else. Short, jagged stares, a furious, silent argument about trading dignity for results. Put them in the car and we'll get going. That's what you want, right? Put them yourself. Eventually, a guy behind the hog farmer broke ranks and stepped forward.
A pragmatist, clearly.
He walked to the car and lifted the hatchback and put the bags inside, one by one, first Kiever's, then Chang's. He closed the hatch and stepped back.
"Thank you," Reacher said.
I hope you all have a great day. He opened the passenger door and slid into the seat. Beside him, Chang slid behind the wheel. They closed their doors as one, and Chang fired up the engine. She backed out of her slot and turned the wheel and took off forward, out into the plaza, and then north, past the diner and the store, to the old wagon train trail, where she turned left and headed west, with the road running straight on ahead of her forever, until it disappeared in the golden haze on the horizon. At that point, as narrow as a needle, she said,
"Are we coming back?"
Reacher took his hand off his gun for the first time since leaving the motel room. He said, "I expect we'll have to come back." Chapter 22. They drove 3 hours and then stopped for gas and food. Still no cell signal. They figured they might not find one until they were all the way over near the I-25 corridor, deep into Colorado. Another 4 hours, maybe. In which case, they might as well head straight for Colorado Springs, which was where the Ford had been rented, and where planes to L.A. took off on a regular basis. They agreed L.A. was next. The telephone was a wonderful invention, but sometimes inadequate, which meant airport security was in their future. So they stripped the Smiths and dumped their constituent parts in separate trash cans all around the rest stop. Easy come, easy go. Then Reacher drove the next spell, unlicensed and illegal, but in 2 hours they saw only two vehicles, neither of which was a cop car. Then Chang took over again, and they drove on until the golden horizon darkened to gray, which meant civilization was on its way. They talked about what to do with Kiever's valise. Reacher, unsentimental about possessions, was in favor of trashing it. But Chang saw it as a talisman, like a beacon of hope. She wanted to keep it with them. In the end, they compromised. They stopped at a FedEx in a strip mall on the edge of Colorado Springs and shipped the valise back to the yellow house on the dead-end street in the faded development north of Oklahoma City. Chang filled out the form with the address, and then after a long hesitation, she checked the box for no signature required. That afternoon, 8 men met at the counter inside the Mother's Rest dry goods store. The store owner was already there, with his 2 shirts and his unkempt hair, and the first to join him was the spare parts guy from the irrigation store, who was followed by the Cadillac driver and the one-eyed clerk from the motel and the hog farmer and the counterman from the diner and the Moynihan who had gotten kicked in the balls and had his gun taken. The 8th man at the meeting came in 5 minutes later. He was a solid guy, red in the face, fresh from a shower, wearing ironed blue jeans and a dress shirt. He was older than Moynihan and the spare parts guy and the Cadillac driver, and younger than the motel clerk and the store owner, and about the same age as the hog farmer and the counterman. He had blow-dried hair, like a news anchor on TV. The other 7 guys stiffened and straightened as he walked in and fell silent and waited for him to speak first. He got straight to the point. He said, "Are they coming back?" No one answered. 7 blank looks. The 8th guy said, "Give me both sides of the argument." There was some silence and squirming and shuffling, and then the spare parts guy said, "They won't come back because we did our jobs. They got nothing here. No evidence, no witnesses. Why would they come back to a dry hole?" The Cadillac driver said, "They will come back because this was Kiever's last known location. They'll come back as many times as it takes. Where else can they start over when they're getting nowhere?" The 8th guy said, "Are we sure they got nothing here?" The counterman said, "No one talked to them. Not a word." The store owner said, "They only used the payphone once. They tried 3 numbers and got no reply from any of them, and then they went away again.
That's not what people do with red-hot information.
So the consensus is they learned nothing.
What?
What you all think?
The Cadillac driver said, what we all think is they learned less than nothing. They finished up in my store, chasing some non-existent guy named Maloney. They were nowhere. But they'll still come back. They know Kiever was here.
So they did learn something.
The store went quiet. The one-eyed guy said, we agreed. It was supposed to look like he wandered off somewhere. We were never going to deny he was here.
The eighth man said, what was their attitude as they left?
The hog farmer said, the guy was throwing his weight around. Some kind of consolation, I figured, making himself feel better. Playing the tough guy, because he knew he was beat. I think the gal was kind of embarrassed by it.
Are they coming back?
I vote no.
Who votes yes? Only the Cadillac driver raised his hand. The eighth man said,
a 6-1 majority, which is a fair assessment. I think you're calling it about right. And I'm proud of you all. They came, they learned nothing except what we could afford for them to know, and they went away again, with only a slight chance they'll be back.
The squirming and shuffling turned a little more upbeat. Chests stuck out and mouths turned down in self-deprecating, aw shucks, grins. The eighth man said, but the world turns on slight chances.
The grins turned to solemn nods, seven serious men agreeing gravely with a pearl of wisdom.
The eighth man asked, where did they go?
Seven shrugs and seven blank looks.
The eighth man said, it doesn't really matter, unless they're headed for Los Angeles. The journalist is our only point of vulnerability. That's the only way they can pick the lock, according to what we learned from Kiever.
1,000,000 to 1, Moynihan said. How could they even know what they're looking for? How would Westwood even know what he's got?
The world turns on 1,000,000 to 1 chances.
We're supposed to be completely invisible, the motel clerk said. Aren't we? Isn't that what we pay for?
You don't pay for it. I pay for it.
The store went quiet again until the spare parts guy picked it up. He said,
okay, isn't that what you pay for?
Yes, it is. And more. I pay for assistance as and when I need it. Like the AAA. All part of the service.
The hog farmer said,
going outside of us is a big step.
Yes, it is, the eighth man said again. There are considerable negatives, but positives, too. We should discuss them.
Moynihan said,
what kind of assistance?
There's a menu. I get what I pay for, from a little to a lot.
The store owner said,
well, I think we should start with surveillance. At least, if they get near Westwood at the newspaper, then we need to know right away, so we're prepared for what comes next, if the 1,000,000 to 1 goes against us.
The other six watched the eighth man's face, waiting for a shoot down, and when none came, they started nodding in agreement, wisely and judiciously. The eighth man said, we should take a vote. All in favor of surveillance?
Moynihan asked,
is that the low end of the menu?
The eighth man nodded.
Phones, internet, and physical eyes on.
How high does a menu go?
All the way to what they call a permanent solution.
We can do that part ourselves.
How's your brother?
I mean, next time we'll be ready.
You changing your mind? Now you think there's a next time?
Silence in the store. The eighth man said,
who votes for surveillance?
Seven hands went up. I'm glad you agree, the eighth man said, because I already made the call. The surveillance started an hour ago. They sent a man named Hackett, one of their best, they said, qualified in a number of different areas. Chapter 23. The car rental company ran a shuttle bus from the returns compound to the passenger terminals, which was convenient but slow. It added another half hour to an already long day. Reacher and Chang got to the ticket counter in the early evening. There was one L.A. flight still to go, but it was sold out. No seats at all, and a long queue for standby. Two equipment failures earlier in the day had caused chaos. Next availability was 8 in the morning. No choice. They took it. Chang had an open return, which she used, and Reacher bought his own seat. The clerk told them boarding would start about 40 minutes prior, at about 7:20 in the morning, and until then there was an airport hotel 5 minutes away by bus. They walked instead, with Reacher carrying Chang's suitcase rather than rolling it, because he figured the cast concrete sidewalks would be tough on its wheels. The hotel was a chain, crisp and white on the outside, warm and beige on the inside, with green neon announcing its name and function. There was a small crowd in the lobby, maybe 9 people, not exactly in line for the desk, mostly just standing around, either talking on cell phones or looking frustrated, or both. Two equipment failures earlier in the day had caused chaos. Reacher was not a frequent flyer, but he recognized the signs. The clerk at the reception desk beckoned them closer. She was a young woman in a fitted jacket with a scarf around her neck. There was some kind of secret urgency in her gesture. She said,
"Sir, madam, I have one room left. If you need it, you should probably grab it now."
Chang said,
"Only one room?" "Yes, ma'am, because the airlines had a problem today." "Is there another hotel?" "Not in the airport."
Reacher said, "We'll take the room." Chang looked at him, and he said, "We'll figure it out." He paid and got a key card in exchange. Fifth floor, room 501. Elevators to the left. Room service until 11. Breakfast extra. Free Wi-Fi. Behind them, two couples had lined up, about to be disappointed. Reacher and Chang rode up to 5 and found the room. It was beige and mint green inside, and adequate in every respect. But Chang was quiet about it. Reacher said,
"You can use it."
She said,
"What will you do?"
"I'm sure I'll think of something." He carried her bag inside and left it by the bed. He gave her the key card and said, "We should go get dinner, before the waifs and strays take all the tables."
"Let me freshen up. I'll meet you in the restaurant."
"Okay."
"Do you need to freshen up? You could use the bathroom first, if you like."
Reacher glanced in the mirror. Recent haircut, recent shave, recent shower, new clothes. He said, "This is about as good as it gets, I'm afraid." The restaurant was on the ground floor, separated from the reception area by the elevator lobby. It was a pleasant space, with drapes and carpet and blonde wood, compromised only a little by stain-proof and scuff-proof and vinyl-coated finishes on every surface. It was capacious, but almost full. Reacher waited at the hostess lectern and was led to a table for two near a window. There was no real view, just yellow lights and a parking lot full of snowplows, mothballed for the summer. Chang arrived 8 minutes later, face washed, hair brushed, wearing a new T-shirt. She sat down opposite Reacher, looking good, energetic again, clearly invigorated by the simple comfort of running water. But then her face changed, as if suddenly she saw the other side of the equation,
which was whatever she had, he didn't. He said,
"Don't worry about it."
She said,
"Where will you sleep?"
"I could sleep right here."
"In a dining chair?"
"I was in the army 13 years. You learn to sleep pretty much anywhere." She paused a beat and said,
"What was the army like?"
"Pretty good, overall. I have happy memories and no real complaints, apart from the obvious."
"Which was?"
"The same as yours, I'm sure. The fantastic cascade of bullshit coming down from senior officers with nothing better to do." She smiled.
"There was some of that."
"Is that why you left?" She stopped smiling. She said,
"No, not exactly."
He said, "I'll tell you if you tell me."
"I don't know if I want to."
"What's the worst thing that can happen?" She paused a beat and breathed in and breathed out and said,
"You first."
They were shedding numbers and therefore picking and choosing. My record was mixed, and right then some particular guy had it in for me. Given those two circumstances, it wasn't exactly a huge surprise my file ended up in the out tray.
"What particular guy?"
"He was a light colonel, a fat guy with a desk job, public relations in Mississippi. I was there with a bad thing going on, and he got all uptight about something ridiculous, and I was mildly impatient with him, verbally, to his face. And he took offense and got his revenge, simply because the timing worked in his favor. I had gotten away with much worse before, when they weren't shedding numbers."
"Couldn't you fight it?"
"I could have called in some IOUs, but the damage was done. It was a zero-sum game. If I won, the colonel would lose, and all the other colonels wouldn't like that. None of them would want me near them. I would have ended up guarding a radar hut in the far north of Alaska, in the middle of winter. It was a lose-lose proposition. Plus, it burst the bubble for me. They really didn't want me there, I finally realized. So I didn't fight it. I took an honorable discharge and walked away."
"When was this?"
"A long time ago."
"And you're still walking?"
"That's too profound."
"You sure?"
"Deep down, I'm very shallow."
She didn't answer. A waitress came by and they ordered. When she left, Reacher said,
"Your turn."
"For what?"
Chang said.
"Your story?"
She paused another beat.
"Same as yours, in a way," she said. "A lose-lose proposition, but of my own making. I let myself get backed into a corner. I didn't see it coming."
"Didn't see what?"
"Someone broke into my house. They took nothing, searched nothing, broke nothing, and left nothing, which I didn't understand at the time. I was working on a money laundering issue. There was a lot of cash and a mazy chain of shell corporations, like always, but I had the guy. But it was a hard case to prove. Almost impossible, in fact. I was leaning toward forgetting it. There's no point in recommending a prosecution if there's no realistic way of winning it. And then the guy came to see me. I was literally on the point of telling him the file was about to be closed, but he spoke first, and he was two steps behind. He told me if I didn't drop it right away, he would claim I had taken a bribe back at the beginning to look the other way. But then, later on, I had changed my mind and stabbed him in the back and kept the money anyway. He figured my work would be tainted, or even excluded, and he would walk."
"People can say all kinds of things. How could he prove it?"
"He had set up a bank account for me in the Caribbean, in my name, and he wired the bribe money to it. It was right there. Large as life. Real money. And a lot of it. It would corroborate everything he was claiming.
Except he opened the account, not you. There must be records.
He told me it was a woman who broke into my house. She took nothing, searched nothing, broke nothing, and left nothing. But she used my landline. She opened the account for me, right there in my house. And it's all over my phone bill. Which left me between a rock and a hard place. How could I prove I didn't make that call? I figured maybe the foreign bank would have a recording, or the NSA, but two women's voices might be hard to tell apart on a long-distance line, especially if she was trying to sound like me, which she probably was, because this was a very organized guy. He knew my social security number, for instance, and my mother's maiden name. That's my security question, apparently.
So what did you do?
What he told me to. I dropped the case. Right away. I closed his file. But I was going to, anyway, I think.
Where is the guy now?
Still in business.
What happened to the bribe money?
It disappeared. I traced it like he knew I would. I found it in a shell corporation in the Dutch Antilles. Apparently, I had purchased a minority position in a financial vehicle as a long-term investment. He was the majority stockholder. We were tied together forever.
So, what next?
I fessed up. I laid it all out for my SAC. I could see he wanted to believe me, but the Bureau doesn't run on faith, and from that point on I would have been useless as an active agent. My testimony would have been automatically suspect, even years later. I would have been a defense counsel's wet dream. As in, Special Agent, please tell us about the bribe you can't prove you didn't take. So I would have joined you in that radar hut in Alaska, in the middle of winter. It was a lose-lose. So I resigned.
That's tough.
You win some, you lose some.
No, you win plenty, and then you lose one. No second chance.
I'm not unhappy doing what I'm doing.
But?
I don't know how much longer we can keep on doing it. It doesn't feel like a job for life.
It might have been for Kiever.
Well, that's very blunt.
What was his story?
Was?
Okay, is.
I heard he was facing a third reprimand. The Bureau is very cautious, and he had a habit of rushing in regardless. No plan, no backup. He was putting cases in jeopardy, they said, as well as himself and his fellow agents. A third strike would have qualified him for Alaska, too. That radar hut would have been getting crowded. So he resigned ahead of the hearing. I guess he thought it was the only dignified thing to do. And before you say it, sure, I agree that's probably what he did in Mother's Rest. He rushed in, regardless. He didn't wait for backup.
The waitress came by with their plates of food and with refills for their drinks. When she was gone, Reacher said,
But Kiever called for backup. He got that far. We know that. Why call and not wait?
Chang said,
Impatience? Urgency?
Maybe they got to him first, while he was waiting. Maybe he didn't rush in.
That sounds like a public service message on behalf of hotheads everywhere.
We don't know what happened.
I wish he had rushed out.
Always a sound policy.
I bet you never did.
More times than I can count, which is why I'm still here having dinner with you. The chaotic universe, Darwinism in action.
She paused and said,
May I ask you a question?
He said, Sure.
Are we having dinner?
That's what it said on the menu. Lunch was different, and this sure ain't breakfast.
No, I mean having dinner, as opposed to grabbing road food.
As in candlelight and piano music?
Not necessarily.
Violin players? And guys selling roses?
If appropriate.
Like a date?
She said. Broadly, I suppose.
He said. Honest answer?
Always.
Suppose we had found Kiever yesterday, maybe stepping off the train, or fallen over in a wheat field somewhere with a sprained ankle, somewhat hungry and thirsty, but otherwise okay. Then yes, for sure, I would have asked you out to dinner, and if you had accepted, then we'd be having that dinner right about now. So I guess this half qualifies.
Only half?
We didn't find Kiva, so it's still partly road food.
But you would have asked me out to dinner?
Absolutely.
Why?
You're the sort of person I like to have dinner with. She was quiet for a long moment, 5 or 6 seconds, right to the edge of discomfort, and then she said,
I would have said yes, for the same reason.
Outstanding.
So keep it straight in your mind. We're having dinner, not grabbing road food. That's a fact, not a question.
Then why did you ask me?
To make sure you knew.
No dining chairs were required that night for Reacher. They ate dessert and drank coffee, slowly, relaxed, not rushing at all, both of them choosing to trust the inevitable. And then Chang signed the check and stood up, and Reacher stood up with her, and she linked her arm in his like they were an old couple from way back, and they walked out together, slowly, relaxed, not rushing at all, and they waited for the elevator and rode up to 5 and opened the room. Then it got a little less slow and a little less relaxed and a little more rushed. Chang was warm and fragrant and smooth and long-limbed and young but not a kid, and she was strong enough to push back, and she was solid enough not to worry about. Reacher liked her a lot, and she seemed to like him back. Afterward, they talked for a spell, and then she fell asleep, and then he did too, the best way he knew. Chapter 24. Boarding started right on time at 7:20 in the morning. Chang rolled her bag down the air bridge, and Reacher followed it all the way to the cheap seats about 2/3 into the plane. Chang put her bag in the overhead and took the window seat. Reacher took the aisle. He said, "How well do you know L.A.?" She said,
"Well enough to find the newspaper building."
Maybe he works from home.
In which case, he won't meet us there. I'm sure his address is a secret, if not his cell phone number. He'll pick a coffee shop in the neighborhood.
Works for me. But which neighborhood? Do you know them all?
I suppose we'll have to rent another car. We should get GPS.
Unless he's in the office and willing to meet us there, we could take a cab.
We'll get in too early. He won't be there yet.
Okay. We'll call his cell when we land and we'll let him make the decision for us. Coffee shop or office? Rental car or cab?
If he agrees to see us at all.
200 deaths? That's a story.
Which he's already heard, according to you, when Kiever's client called him, who seems not to have made much of an impression.
There's a difference between hearing and listening, and that's our problem. I doubt if Westwood even knows what he's got. He didn't listen, and his notes don't seem to mean much. It's going to be like picking a lock with spaghetti.
What if we can't?
No such word.
You're optimistic this morning.
That's an inevitable consequence. I had a very pleasant night.
Me too.
Good to know.
What do your friends call you?
Reacher.
Not Jack?
He shook his head. Even my mother called me Reacher.
Do you have siblings?
I had a brother, name of Joe.
Where is he now?
Nowhere. He died.
I'm sorry.
Not your fault.
What did your mom call him?
Joe.
And she called you Reacher.
It's my name, just as much as Jack. You mean your friends don't call you Chang?
I was Officer Chang, and then Special Agent Chang, but that was only at work.
So what do they call you?
Michelle,
she said.
Or Shell, sometimes, for short, which I quite like. It's a nice diminutive, except not with my last name. Shell Chang sounds somewhere between a Korean porn star and an oil exploration company in the South China Sea and a roll of quarters being dumped in a cash register.
Okay, Reacher said. Michelle it is. Or Chang. And then the plane took off and chased the dawn westward over the mountains. 7 hours by road to the east in Mother's Rest, dawn had already happened. The morning train had been and gone. The breakfast rush in the diner was easing. The guy with two shirts had opened his store. The spare parts guy had opened his too, and was already crammed in behind his counter, sorting invoices into piles. The Cadillac driver was tallying receipts for his 7 different accounts: Western Union, MoneyGram, faxing, photocopying, FedEx, UPS, and DHL. The Moynihan, who had gotten kicked in the balls and had his gun taken, was still home, caring for his brother, who was still a little dazed. And the one-eyed clerk was coming out of the motel office and standing and sniffing the air and glancing all around, at the inside perimeter of the horseshoe, at the parking spaces, at the sidewalk passing the first-floor rooms, at the walkway passing the second-floor rooms, a leisurely visual inspection of the light bulbs, all working, of the lawn chairs, all neatly lined up, all there, all quiet, all serene. 214 was empty. 215 was empty. They weren't coming back, he thought. All good. LAX arrivals was jammed, so Reacher and Chang had to fight their way out to the curb to find a quiet spot to make their call. Chang hid behind a pillar and dialed, and woke Westwood up. Not an early starter. She was embarrassed at first, then placatory, and then she got down to business. She introduced herself again and said she needed to meet, because something that had looked small to both of them was suddenly not so small anymore. She said there was a credible figure of 200 deaths. She said as an ex-FBI agent she was taking it seriously. She said her colleague was from the military and he was also taking it seriously. She said, sure, the book rights were still available. Then she listened to an address and hung up.
Coffee shop, she said, in Inglewood.
Reacher said, that's close by. When?
30 minutes.
We should take a cab. We don't have time to rent a car. 20 miles south of Mother's Rest, the man with the ironed jeans and the blow-dried hair took a call on his landline. AAA, but not exactly. Their man Hackett had logged the first contact,
A cell-to-cell phone call, 6 minutes long, between Westwood, who was presumably at home given his hours, and a woman who gave her name as Chang, who was at the airport, judging by the background noise, and who was with a male colleague she described as military. Deaths had been mentioned, and a rendezvous set up in a coffee shop in Inglewood, which Hackett would monitor. The cab line was long but brisk, and Inglewood was just the other side of the 405 from the airport, so they got to the designated coffee shop with time to spare. The place was one of many lining the street. Most had tiny outdoor tables and Italian words on their chalkboards, but Westwood's pick didn't. It was a straight-up vinyl and linoleum antique, faded over the decades to a dull khaki color. It was about a quarter full, with men on their own, all of them silently reading newspapers or staring into space. None of them looked like a science editor.
"We're early,"
Chang said.
"He'll be late."
So they took a booth, sitting side by side at a laminate table on a bench upholstered in tuck-and-roll vinyl that might have started out deep red and glittery, but was now as khaki as everything else. They ordered coffee, one hot, one iced. They waited. The place was quiet, just the turning of newspaper pages and the clink of ironstone cups on ironstone saucers. 5 minutes. Then eventually Westwood arrived. He looked nothing like Reacher expected, but the reality fit the bill just as well as the preconceptions had. He was an outdoors type, not a lab rat, and sturdy rather than pencil-necked. He looked like a naturalist or an explorer. He had short but unruly hair, fair going gray, and a beard of the same length and color. He was red in the face from sunburn and had squint lines around his eyes. He was 45, maybe. He was wearing clothing put together from high-tech fabrics and many zippers, but it was all old and creased. He had hiking boots on his feet with speckled laces like miniature mountain climbing ropes. He was toting a canvas bag about as big as a mail carrier's. He paused inside the door and identified Chang instantly, because she was the only woman in the place. He slid in opposite, across the worn vinyl, and hauled his bag after him. He put his forearm on the table and said, "I assume your other colleague is still missing. Mr. Kiever, was it?" Chang nodded and said,
"We hit the wall, as far as he's concerned. We're dead-ended. We can trace him so far, but no further."
"Have you called the cops?"
"No."
"So, I guess my first question is, why not?"
"It would be a missing persons report. That's all at this stage. He's an adult, gone 3 days. They might take the report, but they wouldn't do anything with it. It would go straight to the back burner."
200 deaths might get them interested."
"We can't prove anything. We don't know who, why, when, where, or how."
"So, I'm buying you breakfast because there's a guy you haven't even reported missing and 200 deaths you know nothing about."
"You're buying us breakfast because you're getting the book rights. You can buy all the breakfasts."
"Except so far this breakfast alone is worth more than the book rights. So far the book rights and 50 cents will get me a cup of coffee." Reacher said, "You're a scientist. You need to think about it scientifically."
"In what way?"
"Statistically, maybe, and linguistically, with a little sociology thrown in, plus a deep and innate understanding of human nature. Think about the number 200. Sounds like a nice, round figure. But it isn't, really.
No one says 200 purely at random. People say 100, or 1,000, or hundreds or thousands. 200 deaths sounds specific to me, like a true number. Maybe rounded up from the high 180s or 190s, but it sounds to me like there's information behind it. Enough to keep me interested, anyway. For instance, speaking as an investigator. Westwood said nothing. Reacher said, "Plus, we assume the cops already heard the story and already dismissed it." Westwood nodded. "Because you assume Mr. Kiever's client called everyone from the White House downward, including me. Which is where we have to start, with the client. We need to find the guy. We need to hear the story over again, from the beginning, like Kiever did. Then maybe we can predict what happened next."
"I get hundreds of calls. I told you."
"How many?"
"Point taken."
"And you note them all down. You told us that, too."
"Not in any great detail."
"We might be able to puzzle it out."
"You would need a name, at least."
"I think we have a name."
Chang glanced at Reacher.
"Possibly," Reacher said to her.
Then he turned back to Westwood. He said, "It's probably not a real name, but it might be a start. You told us sooner or later you block the nuisance calls when they wear out their welcome. Suppose a guy got frustrated by that and tried to start over by coming back to you under a different name and number."
"Might happen,"
Westwood said. Reacher turned to Chang and said, "Show him Kiever's bookmark." Chang dug the paper out of her pocket and smoothed it on the table. The 323 phone number and Mother's Rest, Maloney. Westwood said,
"That's my number. No doubt about that."
Reacher said, "We took it to mean there was a guy in Mother's Rest named Maloney who was of interest in some way. But there's no such guy. We're sure of that. We asked, and the answers weren't evasive. They were dismissive, and even a little confused. So, what if you had gotten sick of Kiever's client, whatever his name is, so he decided to start over, and he came back to you under the name of Maloney? And then he called Kiever again, and as always told him to check with you for corroboration. But this time, warned him the issue wouldn't be filed under his real name anymore, but under the fake name, Maloney? Maybe that's what this note means."
"Maybe."
"You got a third interpretation?"
"I could check,"
Westwood said. "We'd appreciate it. We're clutching at straws here."
"No shit. Kiever's notes are as bad as mine."
"They're all we've got."
"But even so, with a missing guy and a rumor about 200 deaths, don't you think you should at least try the cops again?"
"I was a cop," Reacher said, "and I knew plenty more. I never met one who went looking for extra work. So right now, they wouldn't listen. Not yet, I can guarantee that. Just like you didn't."
"I could check," Westwood said again. "But I don't see how a fake name will help."
"By leading us to the real name."
"How can it do that?"
"It conceals the real name."
"Check who you blocked just before Maloney started calling. That's the client."
"We'll find more than one candidate. I block lots of people."
"We'll figure it out. Geography could be significant. We know he hired an investigator from Oklahoma City, and we know he reads the L.A. Times. That might narrow it down some."
Westwood shook his head.
"My phone number ain't exactly easy to find. I don't pay Google to put it front and center. If your guy is good enough with computers to dig it up off the Internet, then he's reading the paper online. That's for sure. Guys like that haven't bought physical print for a decade. He could be living anywhere. Good to know, Reacher said. Meet me in my office in an hour, in the Times building. Chang nodded and said, I know where it is.
Then the waitress came by, and Westwood ordered breakfast, and Reacher and Chang left him alone to eat it. Less than 10 minutes later, 20 miles south of Mother's Rest, the man with the iron jeans and the blow-dried hair took a second call on his landline. His contact told him Hackett had observed the meeting in the Inglewood coffee shop. He had not been close enough to hear much detail, but he had caught Kiever's name, and he had lip-read Chang say they had hit the wall where he was concerned. Then at the end of the conversation, he had inferred a second rendezvous had been suggested at a location he hadn't caught, but he had heard Chang saying she knew where it was. He would stay on Westwood for the time being, who would no doubt lead him there.
Chapter 25. The L.A. Times was in a fine old Art Deco building on West 1st and Spring in downtown Los Angeles. It had security worthy of a government agency. There was an X-ray belt and a metal detector. Reacher wasn't sure why. Maybe an inflated sense of importance. He doubted if the Times was on top of anyone's target list. Probably not even on the 4th or 5th page. But there was no choice. He dumped his coins in a bowl and stepped through the hoop. Chang was slower. She still had her suitcase and her coat. But eventually they were through, and they got passes from a desk and rode up in an elevator. Westwood's office turned out to be a square cream room with shelves of books and stacks of newspapers. There was a handsome old desk under the window with a two-screen computer on it. Westwood was in a chair in front of it reading email. His enormous canvas bag was dumped on the floor, bellied open, full of more books and more newspapers and a metal laptop computer. Outside the door, the hall was loud with the hum of busy people doing busy things. Outside the window, the sky was bright with Southern California's perpetual sunshine. Westwood said, I'll be right with you. Take a seat. Something in his voice. Taking a seat required a little effort. Reacher and Chang cleared stacks of magazines and papers off two spare chairs. Westwood closed his email program and turned around. He said, My legal department isn't happy. There are confidentiality issues at stake. Our database is private. Chang asked, What kind of downside do they foresee? Unspecified. They're lawyers. Everything is downside. It's an important investigation. They say important investigations come with warrants and subpoenas, or at least missing persons reports. Reacher said, Why did you talk to your lawyers? Westwood said, Because I'm required to. Did you talk to your managing editor? He doesn't see a story. We ran background on Kiever. He's on a bender somewhere. He's a washed-up old gumshoe. Chang said nothing. Reacher said, I never met the guy, but I met plenty like him. Above average in every way, except loose with impulse control. But those impulses came from the best of intentions. And however washed up he was James Bond compared to the population of Mother's Rest. But still, they got him.
You don't know that.
But suppose they did. Suppose there's something weird out there with 200 dead people. That's a story, right? That's something the L.A. Times would eat up with a spoon. You could run it for weeks. You could get a Pulitzer. You could get on TV. You could get a movie deal.
Get back to me as soon as you get something solid.
What do you think the chances are of that happening?
100 to 1.
Not 200?
Your theories aren't evidence.
Here's another theory. We walk out of here, leaving behind the 100-to-1 possibility there's a big story out there, But because we're gone, it's no longer a Times exclusive anymore. Which means if the 100-to-1 pays off and it breaks, there's going to be a crazy scramble with all the papers competing for pole position. So if you're a smart science editor, even though it's only 100-to-1, you can see a tiny advantage in using what you know so far to get somewhat prepared ahead of time. So my guess is, as soon as we're back in the elevator, you're going to check the database for calls from a guy named Maloney. Just to put your mind at rest. Westwood said nothing. Reacher said,
"So, what difference would it make if we were still in the room?"
No response for a long moment. Then Westwood turned his chair to face his screens, and he clicked the mouse and typed a few letters in two different boxes. User ID and password, Reacher figured. The database, hopefully. Chang leaned forward. The screen showed a search page. Some kind of proprietary software, no doubt suitable for the job at hand, but ugly. Westwood clicked on a bunch of options, isolating his own notes, possibly, to avoid irrelevant results. Maybe there were 100 newsworthy Maloneys in L.A. Maybe there were 200. Sports stars, business people, actors, musicians, civic dignitaries. Westwood said, "All theories should be tested. That's a central part of the scientific method." He typed Maloney. He clicked the mouse. He got 3 hits. The database showed contact made by a caller named Maloney on 3 separate occasions. The most recent was just shy of a month previously, and the second was 3 weeks before that, and the oldest was 2 weeks before the second. A 5-week envelope, all told, 4 weeks ago. The incoming phone number was the same on all 3 occasions. It had a 501 area code, which no one recognized. Westwood had made no notes about the subject or the content of any of the 3 conversations. Instead, he had simply routed name, number, day, and time straight to a folder marked C. "Which is?" Reacher asked.
"Conspiracies,"
Westwood said.
"What kind of thing?"
"It's a fairly wide category."
"Give me an example."
"Smoke alarms are compulsory in homes because they contain cameras and microphones wirelessly linked to the government, with poison gas capsules, too, in case the government doesn't like what you're saying or doing."
"Kiever wouldn't waste time on a thing like that."
"And I wouldn't ignore something more serious."
"Maybe it wasn't well explained."
"I guess it can't have been."
"You sure you don't remember this Maloney guy at all?" As a response, Westwood clicked his way through to an unfiltered list of all the calls he had received. The screens were big, and he had 2 of them, but even so, there was space only for a small part of the calendar year. Reacher said,
"Are we in there?"
Westwood nodded.
"From this morning."
"What folder did you put us in?"
"I haven't decided yet."
Chang took out her phone and dialed Maloney's number, the 501 area code and 7 more digits. She put her phone on speaker. There was hiss and dead air as the cellular system hooked her up. Then the number rang, and rang, and rang. No answer, and no voicemail. Chang hung up after a whole long minute, and the office went quiet. Reacher said,
"We need to know where the 501 area code is."
Westwood clicked off his database and opened up a web browser. Then he glanced at the door and said,
"So, I guess we're really doing this."
"No one will know," Reacher said, "until the movie comes out."
The computer told them 501 was one of 3 area codes given to cell phones in Arkansas. Chang said,
"Was there an Arkansas number you blocked about 9 weeks ago? Maybe our guy switched from his landline to his cell. Simple as that."
Westwood went back into his database to the unfiltered list of calls, and he scrolled back 9 weeks and said,
"How much limbo should we give him? How fast would he have come up with the idea of changing his name and number?"
"Pretty fast," Reacher said. "It isn't brain surgery. But I'm guessing there was some limbo, most likely because of hurt feelings. You rejected him. It might have taken him a week to swallow his pride and call you back."
Westwood scrolled some more. 10 weeks back. He opened the list of area codes on his second screen and went back and forth, comparing line by line, and when he was finished, he said, "I blocked 4 guys that week, but none of them was from Arkansas."
Reacher said, "Try the week before. Maybe he's more sensitive than we thought."
Westwood scrolled again, backward through the next 7 days, and then forward again, checking against the list of area codes, and he said, "I blocked 2 guys the previous week for a 14-day total of 6, but still no one from Arkansas."
Reacher said, "We're getting somewhere, anyway. The Maloney calls started 9 weeks ago from a guy who had just gotten blocked in a recent window of time, and in that category there are 6 possible candidates. Logic says our guy is one of them, and we could be talking to him 30 seconds from now on his other line, because you have all the original phone numbers."